This is Tuesday, May 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, did he or didn't he? Did President Donald Trump reveal confidential information to Russian officials during a White House meeting?
It was wholly appropriate to share what the threat was as a basis for common action and coordination.
However, questions remain. Jim Malone is here, VOA's national correspondent. We'll be talking about that. Also ahead, did North Korea have a hand in this week's major worldwide cyber attack? And we explore how new U.S. immigration policy may be hurting the nation's farming industry. It's all in today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump today defended his absolute right to share information with Russian officials at a White House meeting last week, pushing back against media accounts that he disclosed highly classified intelligence related to the Islamic State. In an early morning tweet, two of them, as a matter of fact, Trump said he wanted to pass on facts pertaining to terrorism and airline flight safety as he met in the Oval Office with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Moscow's U.S. Ambassador Sergei Kislyak and urged Russia to greatly step up their fight against Islamic State and terrorists. Trump appeared to be boasting about inside knowledge of a looming threat to aviation, according to the Washington Post. A New York Times report said the information, which was deemed to be especially sensitive, had not even been shared widely with the U.S. government or shared with other allies. The U.S. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster yesterday said no confidential information was discussed at the meeting, but in the past hour or so, McMaster defended his president's actions and discussion during the meeting.
The president was meeting with the foreign minister about the terrorist threat. He had also raised some difficult issues, what we expected in terms of different behavior from Russia in key areas like Ukraine and as in Syria. But then the president was emphasizing, hey, we have some common interests here. We have to work together in some critical areas. And we have an area of cooperation with transnational terrorist organizations, ISIS in particular, an organization that had already taken down a Russian airliner and murdered over 200 people in October of 2015. And so this was the context of the conversation in which it was wholly appropriate to share what the threat was as a basis for common action and coordination.
Well, joining us on International Edition are VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone and our social media guru here on the International Edition, Andrew Palcheski. Jim, let's start with you. The story most likely doesn't end here. Where does it now stand?
Well, you have, for example, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, calling on the White House to release a transcript of the meeting where the president supposedly had these discussions with the Russian officials. There are other calls, including from some Republicans, for a classified briefing on the information that was conveyed and whether anything was put at risk. So McMaster's appointment recently, or his appearance, I don't think has put to rest a lot of the questions about what exactly did the president do. At one point, in fact, McMaster seemed to say the president didn't even know the sourcing of the material he was releasing to the Russians.
Yeah, he did.
That gets
that.
Into
yeah.
a lot of other questions
sure does,
about
yeah.
what their processes are there at the White House. Look, we're getting to the point here where it's almost a crisis a day. So on a bigger picture scale, I think there are questions here about how much can they get back on track on their agenda. And don't forget, they've got this huge trip coming up, the president's first international trip beginning later this week.
Well, we haven't heard this reaction as yet, but I'm sure it is coming because it's coming every other one of these crises, and that's blaming what Trump has called the fake media. Is he going to do that again? And does the media stand to have any responsibility for any of this?
Trump's hardcore allies, I've noticed, on the far right have been whipped up about this. So they are calling it fake news. But here's the problem for the White House. You have Republicans now standing up a bit more and questioning. Senator McCain said he was deeply disturbed, if this is all true, by what he's heard. And Senator Bob Corker, who's chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, certainly an ally of the president in the past, has said that the Trump White House, given all these recent problems seems to be in what he called a downward spiral. So there's an overall kind of effect here that's very chaotic at the very least. And given how the White House handled the James Comey firing last week, the various explanations, the shifting explanations, there's a bigger issue, and I'm going to write about this in the next day or two, about the president's credibility now.
Well, it's also the credibility of the entire United States on a worldwide scope, is it not?
It'll be put to the test as he goes on this trip. Will this domestic baggage follow him? I think it will to an extent. How does he deal with that? And to what, if any extent, is there any diminished confidence in his ability that he's up to the job at this point? There have been some Democrats that have suggested this. And of course, the president is always quick to push back. He pushed back on Twitter, as you noted, that what he did was fine. He has the right to share information.
Well, it should be pointed out that the president does have the power to unclassify or declassify any information that he deems fit. Is that correct?
He has the power to fire the FBI director as well. And yet, why are we talking about these things? Because there are political consequences to all these actions. And he may want to emphasize the fact he can do it. But you have to explain things, too. And the problem with Comey was the constant changing of the explanation. And we're starting to see a little bit more now on this. McMaster's initial response to the Washington Post story was to completely denounce it last night. Now it's parts of it are problematic. So the administration is under the gun and Democrats are pouncing. Republicans, a lot of them are being quiet, but even Mitch McConnell, the leader of Senate Republicans, says, frankly, he could use a little less drama from the White House these days.
Let me bring into the conversation Andrew Palczewski, who is, as always, I think he does it 24 hours a day, sleeps with his smartphone in his face. But nevertheless, what is the overall public reaction on social media about all this?
There's a lot of public reaction that we've seen, not just to this, but to other instances, as Jim mentioned, the crisis a day where you have the divide politically, as there always is on social media. You have Trump supporters coming to his defense, his detractors pointing out whatever the crisis is du jour. But I want to start with those tweets that you and Jim mentioned that President Trump sent out earlier today, where he said, as president, I wanted to share with Russia, which I have the absolute right to do. And then not too long after he sent those out, a tweet from the Associated Press where they report a European official has told the Associated Press that their country might stop sharing intelligence with the U.S. if Trump gave classified information to Russian diplomats. So this has sparked a lot of people on social media saying, Trump's right, he can share whatever information he wants with whoever he wants, but those actions have consequences, and that's what we're seeing in this Associated Press tweet. Important to note, they did not name the country, so there is some questioning about whether it's a major ally or a, you know, quote-unquote minor ally.
Well, but, I saw an interview with one of the reporters from the Washington Post last night who said they know what country it is, but they were asked by the United States government not to reveal whatever country that was. So they know what it is.
And these are the intricacies, by the way, that social media is really picking apart and highlighting all these different kind of twists and turns as we go through these stories today with H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, as he stood at the podium in the press briefing room. Lots of talk about the spin, really almost line by line, people going through and dissecting what he was saying. A lot of people saying that they had a drink for every time he said wholly appropriate, they would be passed out on the floor. So a lot of criticism for what he's saying. But again, then we have the people coming to his defense saying that he's trying to stand up for the administration.
Jim, let me go back to you. The story here says that Trump was informed that he had broken protocol after the meeting was over by White House officials who then, said the Associated Press, reached out to the National Security Agency and the CIA in an effort to contain any damage. So not everybody's on the same page in the White House, obviously.
Yes, and McMaster was asked about that, and he said, well, they're going out of an extra dose of caution to make those calls. And by the way, Ira, would you like to be the one who has to go to the president and tell him that he had broken with protocol? One last point here on the overall chaos that I mentioned. You know, if you go back in Donald Trump's career as a businessman, he loved to be in the newspapers and the broadcast media in New York. It was the way he operated. He felt it was important to have his name out there at all times, to be in there, good or bad. And I think we're seeing this embattled effect of this president now, whether it's Comey or these other things. Sometimes he likes to be at the center of the maelstrom. He's used to that. Maybe he thinks it's a way to distract from some of the issues they're having, but it also leads to a lot of chaos, which can also distract from their agenda.
And also what had been talked about during the campaign, and that was whether or not someone from a business culture who had never been in politics would be able to apply that structure of the business world into politics. But so far, it's leading to all kinds of problems.
Well, his supporters really embraced that part of it, and so far, the hardcore group are sticking with him.
Jim Malone, VOA's national correspondent, Andrew Palshewski, VOA's and International Edition's social media guru, with us on International Edition. Thanks, guys. Here are the stories we are covering for you. U.S. President Donald Trump defends his absolute right to share information with Russian officials at a White House meeting last week. Some cybersecurity experts say there's some tenuous evidence that North Korea contributed to this week's worldwide cyber attack. A week after sparking anger in Turkey by authorizing arming Syrian Kurds, President Trump is hosting the Turkish president at the White House. The Iraqi military says it surrounded Islamic State jihadists in the Iraqi city of Mosul, and that the extremist group only controls about 10% of the area in the western half of the city. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition, and this is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A billion-dollar industry has grown from a theory that a person's intelligence can be increased or at least maintained by exercising the brain with a series of games. The number of books and websites that offer this cognitive learning has dramatically increased over the past decade. A new study from researchers at Florida State University tested the theory that these brain training games can help a person sustain cognitive function, especially as they age. Study co-author Walter Boot says the group's findings and previous studies provide little evidence that brain training games can actually improve someone's life in a meaningful way. The study's lead author, Neil Charnas, notes that other research suggests aerobic exercise, more so than mental exercises, is great for the brain. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues now. North Korea is suspected by some security experts of being behind the WannaCry global cyber attack that crippled hundreds of thousands of computers starting last Friday. We welcome to International Edition John Lindsay. He is Assistant Professor of Digital Media and Global Affairs, also the Director of the Trudeau Center for Peace, Conflict and Justice at the University of Toronto's Monk School of Global Affairs. John, what do we know about the origins of this latest ransomware attack?
So the link to Korea is merely suspected based on some similarities in the software code in the current WannaCry ransomware and previous hacks that have been linked to North Korea by a group that is known as the Lazarus Group. It's connected to North Korea for various reasons. But I want to emphasize that the only information we have is sort of a circumstantial link between an artifact and the code.
And so it's tenuous at best, right?
Absolutely. So this could be a third-party hacker that borrowed code both from the NSA exploit that was released by the shadow brokers as well as from the Lazarus Group code, which is out in the open. So criminals are very creative in mixing and matching sources from all kinds of different pieces of code.
And I checked just a few minutes ago, and we have been checking all day about the possibility of Pyongyang saying anything about this. You haven't heard anything about them saying anything related to this. Is that correct?
That is correct. I haven't heard anything. I will say it is consistent with North Korea's MO as far as their cyber operations go, which can be divided into politically motivated operations, but the vast majority of their operations are criminally motivated. This is a regime that's under tremendous, you know, financial economic sanctions. They've got a big need for cash, and, you know, cyber operations are a great way to go about doing that, right? So one of the heists that the Lazarus Group is most well known for is this 2016 operation against a number of banks, especially a Bangladeshi bank, where they were able to get $81 million. So they have little motivation to, you know, claim responsibility for that. That's why they try and work through these cutout groups.
You most likely have heard at least the rumors. There is no proof of it that we have been able to find out that the U.S. has been involved in cyber interference of the North Korean missile test, perhaps nuclear test, and one might conjecture, come up with conjecture that this might be a reason for them to do something.
That's certainly possible. That is one thing we should be looking, you know, closely into. You're right. I do think there is a high possibility that the U.S. is trying to interfere in the North Korean nuclear program, whether they've been successful or the North Koreans are just having trouble with their missile technology. That's a separate question. That's certainly possible. But another possibility would be that this is yet another influence operation run by the shadow brokers themselves, which, as we know, have connections to Moscow. And this would be very, very embarrassing, right, to show that the NSA's tools, their top-grade tools, are now being released into the wild, are being co-opted by criminals. They are, you know, causing disruption around the world. So that is yet another plausible story. So we just really can't jump to an attribution conclusion at this point.
John Lindsay is Assistant Professor of Digital Media and Global Affairs, Director of the Trudeau Center for Peace, Conflict and Justice at the University of Toronto's Monk School of Global Affairs. Thanks, John, so much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This is VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
This is International Edition from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. North Korean claims that its newly tested ballistic missile can carry a nuclear warhead appear to explain a subtle but significant shift in the way U.S. intelligence views Pyongyang. Top officials who once described North Korea as a second-tier adversary with more intent than capability are now referring to it as an increasingly grave threat, bent on demonstrating that the U.S. will soon be within its military reach. Well, like elsewhere in America, farmers and fruit growers in the eastern state of Pennsylvania rely heavily on immigrants, mainly Hispanic, to tend the fields and harvest the crops. Many entered the U.S. illegally, but have settled in rural communities across the country, raising families while working the fields and paying taxes withdrawn from their paychecks by employers who comply with federal hiring regulations. However, stepped-up immigration enforcement by the Trump administration is threatening this way of life, according to farmers and food processors who feel they'll not have enough workers to stay in business. VOA's Bill Rogers reports from Adams County in southeastern Pennsylvania.
It's pruning time for the apple trees in this part of Pennsylvania. And these orchards, like so many others, are being tended by Hispanic immigrant workers. It's repetitive, often tedious work that takes hours. farm work that few native-born Americans will do anymore, says Kay Hollabaugh, who helps run a family farm and orchard in Adams County.
If my immigrant workforce is taken away, I don't have anybody to harvest my fruits and vegetables. It will be the end of our business. 75 people will not have a job, and my family, who has been here over 60 years, will lose this.
The nearby town of York Springs is home to some of the Hispanic immigrants who work on the farms. But few are out on the streets in this community of some 800 people, almost half Hispanic. They're scared following recent arrests by immigration agents.
Before it was different. It was more relaxed. People would go out and walk around. They weren't afraid. Today it's very different. People aren't hiding. Most of the people have left town. They returned to their countries before anything else happens.
The Rice Fruit Company packing house, which employs some people from York Springs, also needs immigrant labor. Rice Fruit has 100 people working year-round, double that number at harvest time. Most come from Latin America.
No question about it, there is a great deal of anxiety.
Company President David Rice says while everyone on the payroll has the necessary documents to work legally, there's still a climate of fear.
It's really unfortunate because those people, you know, very, very fine workers and very, very fine people who are contributing a lot to the local economy and an immense amount to the apple economy particularly.
The Adams County fruit industry generates $580 million a year, according to one study, and almost 20,000 jobs. But if immigrant workers start to leave the area, Rice says he'll have to downsize.
We're looking at ways to reduce our labor needs, and that involves more automation. I mentioned the possibility of downsizing our orchards so that we're only harvesting the most profitable and the most labor-efficient orchards. Those are very real options in terms of dealing with the reduced labor force.
Bill Rogers reporting. You've been listening to International Edition. Our thanks to Director Patrice Martin, our engineer John Dryden. I'm Ira Melman in Washington, D.C. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Yemen's two-year conflict between the Houthi rebels and the country's elected government, supported by a Saudi-led coalition, has left the people of Yemen, in the words of Norwegian humanitarian leader Jens Egeland, facing a famine of biblical proportion. According to the United Nations, since the conflict broke out in March 2015, nearly 4,800 civilians have been killed and more than 8,200 others have been injured. At the same time, more than 3 million Yemenis have been displaced since the start of the crisis, and some 70% of the country, or nearly 19 million people, is in need of humanitarian assistance. Today, over 17 million Yemenis are at risk of starvation. The fighting has caused an economic collapse and severely restricted the importation of food, medicine, and fuel. Even before the crisis, Yemen relied on imports for 90% of its food and most of its fuel and medicines. This means that until the fighting stops, there is little chance Yemen will be able to stave off the looming humanitarian catastrophe on its own. The United States is one of Yemen's largest donors of aid. In late April, the U.S. government announced nearly $94 million in additional humanitarian assistance to help the people of Yemen. This brings the total U.S. humanitarian contribution to Yemen to nearly $526 million since the 2016 fiscal year. The funds will go toward food and clean drinking water to vulnerable families, as well as nutrition treatment for malnourished children. It will also provide hygiene kits to fight the spread of disease, as well as life-saving medical supplies and training for healthcare workers. There will also be emergency shelter for those who had been displaced by the fighting. Conflict is the primary driver of this humanitarian crisis. The United States remains committed to providing humanitarian support to the people of Yemen, while we work to end the conflict through a comprehensive peace agreement. The United States calls upon all parties to ensure unimpeded access for commercial and humanitarian goods throughout the country. We also urge other humanitarian donors to increase their level of support during this critical time of need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.